This is Dominic Enyart with a quick pre-program note. We will be celebrating the life of my father, Bob Enyart, at Applewood Baptist Church this Saturday. Doors will be opening at 9 a.m. for the memorial service. We hope to see you there. That's Applewood Baptist Church this Saturday. Doors open at 9 a.m.
I am your host, Doug McBurney, here in the Worldview Studios. It's good to be back. It's good to have you back. Thanks for sticking with us as we roll into another half hour of, well, hopefully thought-provoking, edifying, and sometimes entertaining, maybe even funny, broadcasting here as we continue. As the week continues, we must continue into the personhood file here at the Weekly Worldview. A young woman in Britain, 26-year-old woman, she was born with Down syndrome. And in England, the formerly Great Britain, sometimes referred to as British, they have abortion regulations that, well, they claim that abortions are forbidden, absolutely forbidden, forbidden, we said. I believe they're forbidden after 24 weeks. We'll have none of that. We will simply not tolerate any abortion after 24 weeks, except for this list of exceptions that include, amongst a number of others, Down syndrome. Well, actually more than just Down syndrome. Actually, any serious handicap or mental abnormality, deformity, any substantial risk that the child would suffer. You could pretty much just put it that way. If there's any chance the child could suffer, even if it's after 24 weeks, well, we can certainly consider killing the child. Legally, of course.
All right, we slipped into channeling someone from the Minister of Parliament or something like that.
So technically, abortion is forbidden in England after 24 weeks. Yeah, but not really. So this young woman in England, Heidi Crowder, she filed a lawsuit against the British government asking them to strike down the exception that they made for her. Why did she have standing to do that? Because it was legal to kill her after 24 weeks. And by the way, there's nothing that says after 26 years in the law. It says that you can kill a person for having Down syndrome even if they're older than 24 weeks. And even if they're younger than 24 weeks, and then who knows where this goes. Where does it go? It goes to 26 years is where it'll go eventually. And so she filed a lawsuit, and she was defeated. As you can well imagine, this is England after all. Two senior judges ruled against her. No, they didn't rule against her. They just dismissed her case. What was their argument? But they just dismissed her, is what they did. They just dismissed her. Just like the law in England dismisses the lives of every child in the womb. I know they have it dressed up with some regulations that make them all drink their tea and feel just fine about it. It's all not neat and clean, you know. But in fact, they not only dismissed Heidi Crowder, they dismissed every child in England and every disabled person in England, these two judges. Anyway, in this particular case of people that they like to kill, which one of them is Heidi Crowder, they don't just want to dismiss her, they want to kill her. She knows that intuitively. If not her, then her children, her grandchildren, her great-grandchildren. Heidi's not a dummy. Heidi might have Down syndrome, but she's not deluded enough to believe that you can dress up murdering children as anything but murdering children, and that threatens everyone. And so Heidi had the good sense that these two judges don't have. Their argument was, not all mothers want to blah, 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 blah. It just really doesn't matter what they said. Not all mothers want to do a lot of things. How that has any impact on you legalizing the murder of innocent people, that I don't understand. These two judges should both be arrested and locked in a cage on an island somewhere, and Heidi Crowder should be installed in their circuit and take over the entire circuit. She should rule on every case going forward. If you think I'm joking about that, that's not even close to a joke. Deadly serious. If I was king of the world, those two guys would be in a cage on a rock somewhere with nothing except buzzards on the outside, and Heidi would rule from the bench, and I would let her design her own robe. Now, I want to get into a very disturbing report from the media. I consume some media, not a lot, because I can't take it. As a matter of fact, since Bob Enyart departed from here to go there, to go to heaven, and to be with all the people that he led to the Lord, and to just revel in the victory that he had over all of his enemies who hated him all those years. He just reveled in the joy of all the friends he made. Before all that happened, I listened to the radio all the time while I was driving. And since Bob died, I have not listened to the radio in the car. And I'm kind of bummed because I just invested a lot of money into a very expensive aftermarket radio and I'm not listening to it. But that's okay because I'm driving around and I'm actually allowing my own thoughts to percolate up in my head and then I'm pondering them and I'm trying to think them through. And this is on the advice of a young man. I'm not going to give his name, but a young man who was influenced by Bob Enyart's ministry. He told me that he had read somewhere in a book that, you know, one of the problems with modern life is that we never have quiet time. If we're driving, we're listening to the radio. If we're not driving, we're on our phone and we're seeing something, consuming some media, listening, right? We just never have time when we just can think in silence. And when he said that, I kind of was like, yeah, it's probably true. You know, I definitely have too many media streams in my life. There's no doubt about that. And sometimes it drives me crazy. Sometimes I throw my phone onto my desk because I'm like, leave me alone. Just leave me alone sometimes. Anyway, so I didn't decide. This just kind of organically occurred. I just began not listening to the radio in the car. By the way, if you're in your car listening to me on the radio, thank you very much. Don't stop listening on my account. But I haven't been able to. I've had no desire to. The KLT's probably thrilled to hear this. That's it, Doug. Tell people that. Thanks a lot. This is why you never had a radio career. Thank you very much. No, you know why I never had a radio career? I never had a radio career because when I first started and tried to be on the radio, I thought that I could kind of be like the other conservatives I was listening to at the time. This would have been in the mid to late 1990s. I thought that I could walk a fine line between doing right by God, but not offending a lot of people by mentioning Jesus too much, or maybe even at all. And I had seen and heard an awful lot of radio hosts who called themselves Christians upon occasion, or at least they alluded to God upon occasion, but they assiduously avoided topics like the murder of innocent children, homosexual perversion, other sexual immorality, the government schools, and they pretty much stuck to politics and elections and I think guns. They would be willing to talk about guns and money. Yeah, money and guns and votes. And as long as they stuck with that, they could stick God in there every once in a while and make like $20 million a year. So at one time, I thought that might be possible in my life. But I realized that once I actually got on the air and started talking, that I couldn't help but talk about what I knew God would want me to talk about. And that's because Bob Enyart had an influence on me. He did the same thing. When I first met him, he was on his way to being big like, maybe not like Rush, because nobody would ever be big like Rush, but he was going to be big like, bigger than, this is embarrassing that I can't think of their names, but it actually says something about them. I can't think of their names.
I don't know
And, you know, the second stringers, the guys who regurgitated whatever Rush said during the day. Not Sean Hannity. He was the main regurgitator. That was his job, was to simply carry Rush's audience for his advertisers for another 3 hours. There it is. Bob was on his way to being bigger than Dennis Prager, one of the guys I couldn't think of his name. Although I like a lot of stuff Dennis Prager has done, don't get me wrong. Just listening to him on the radio, it's like taking a sleeping pill. I just can't take it. But I like a lot of the things he's written, a lot of things he's done. In fact, we should pick someone less than Dennis Prager. And I'm trying, not Michael Medved, although he's pretty low down the food chain. There's an even worse one that's just intolerable, sufferable, horrible to listen to. He's a hack Republican. He wears thick glasses. He's got a square head and kind of shock whitish gray hair. And I can't think of his name, but I detest everything about his show. Almost everything he's ever said or represented in his life makes me want to hurl. And I can't think of his name, but you know who I'm talking about, right? Well, Bob was on his way to being bigger than those guys. But he could not help himself. He could not help himself but to say the things he knew God wanted him to say, even though I don't even know if he knew this at the time, because talk radio was all relatively new. Nobody knew how many tens of millions and billions of dollars was going to be involved. But I wonder if he knew that that truncated his potential for popularity, especially talking about sexual immorality as it related to homosexuality back then and the public schools. The public schools was the big third rail that nobody else was ever willing to address. That's it, Hugh Hewitt. So Bob had more talent in his nose hair than Hugh Hewitt has in his entire body, career, his entire lineage going back six generations. And Bob would have been bigger than him in a secular sense. But instead, Bob chose to be bigger than him in a much more important sense. How he would impact the trajectory of the lives of the people who were listening. Rather than focusing on ratings and trying to be popular with this political party or that political party, or to go along with precedent and be look like a smart guy when it came to the Constitution and the law and all of that. I don't even know if I can do a Hugh Hewitt imitation. I don't think it's possible. I don't think it's possible to do an imitation of such a vacuous, empty suit. I would just have to have like 30 seconds of silence. Anyway, so Hugh Hewitt will be remembered in whatever small way he's remembered when this all shakes out. And we all go on from this relatively brief sojourn here on this planet. And we go on to a much, much longer sojourn. Not even a sojourn. Our final destination. Once we get to what we were actually intended for, which was eternal life in heaven. How do I know that? Well, because the earth was originally part of heaven. It says that in the Bible. We were meant to live in heaven forever. And so Hugh Hewitt and all the guys who made the tens of millions and Hugh Hewitt probably makes not as much as anyway. But all the guys who made all the money and got popular and got syndicated on 300 stations, 400 stations, because they assiduously avoided the topics that God cared the most about, they will have their reward. They're having it now. Hugh Hewitt gets to go on CNN and Fox News because he's so broad-minded. So he goes on network TV and he shills for a little bit, gets scale. He goes on Fox News, shills a bit, gets scale. But it's before, by the end of the day, you're talking some real money. So anyway, they'll have their reward for whatever that's worth. And then Bob Enyart, who decided to talk about the things that really needed to be talked about, and cared more about having an impact on the trajectory of his audience's life and their children's, well, he gets his reward. You know, a colleague of mine long ago, whenever he was confronted by an atheist or an unbeliever, or he was called a right-wing religious fanatic or a Bible thumper or a fundamentalist, he used to just look at the person over his glasses, and then he would calmly say, "May God reward you according to your works." That's what he would say, kind of a passive-aggressive, back-of-the-hand type of thing. And I always thought that was pretty effective. Anyway, that gets me. I was talking about the media. I'm sorry. I got to go. Hey, this from the End of Civilization file. I was consuming a little bit of media the other day in the form of Tucker Carlson, who I watch upon occasion. And Tucker Carlson had Andy Ngo on. Andy Ngo is an investigative journalist, and he's a homo. That's right. He's a homo. And he was the second homo that Tucker Carlson had on the air the other day. Two of them. Tucker almost always has at least one homo on. Sometimes he doubles down. Tucker was reporting on the pervert who flashed the people in the spa out in L.A., this guy named Merriger. And who, by the way, the flasher declared himself a transgender, a woman. And so Andy Ngo is on Tucker Carlson talking about the pervert who declared himself a woman. And Andy Ngo refers to the pervert flasher as she. Yeah, he refers to the pervert flasher as she. Yeah, he says, quote, the details is that she was convicted of, and then I don't want to say what this pervert did. But anyway, Tucker just sat there and went along with it. Tucker sat there and went along with Andy Ngo, a homo, referring to a tranny as she. Tell me this isn't the end of civilization. It's the Weekly Review. I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back. Yes, it's always good to have you back here on the Weekly Worldview. As I said, I'm Doug McBurney, your host. Joined in studio, as always, by my extremely attractive audio engineer. Thank you very much. She helps make me sound good. Is that bad grammar?
Yeah.
She helps make me sound well? How could I say it? She helps make me sound, period. That's all. Gooder. That's it. Gooder, getter, better. All right. From the Desperately Seeking file. And so this is a story from the Atlantic. I read a story from it's the Atlantic Monthly. It's an old magazine that's skewed to the left more and more over the years to where now they're just on a grease pole. Just every issue is just slid to hell on a grease pole, jet rockets and all. And this week they make the Desperately Seeking file. Couldn't think of what they were desperately seeking because I can't relate. But the authors at the Atlantic Monthly are desperately seeking something. And they report on the Roe baby is what they call her. And this is the baby that was at the heart of the Roe versus Wade decision back in January 1973. They talk about Norma McCorvey, who was Jane Roe, who was a waitress in Dallas, a bit of a slut, got herself pregnant on a number of occasions, never really got married, and how she challenged the law there in Texas. By the way, there was a law back then that prohibited abortion, except a number of, there were a number of exceptions, but the liberals, they didn't just want that. They didn't just want to regulate the killing of children, and this is something that gets to the heart of people. The frothing at the mouth leftists, they want to kill every baby. That's all I can. I can't imagine why else, when they have a law that says you can kill almost every baby and the left has to fight for more. It's just an insight into how evil these people are. You know, the Republicans, they just want to have a law against abortion so that they can get your vote. But then if they actually need to have an abortion for one of the women that they cheat on their wife with, well, the Republicans would like to have the law written so that, you know, at least the option's available. And that's pretty wicked. That's pretty corrupt. But the Republican, he's just obsessed with cheating on his wife. He's not obsessed with destroying mankind. Although you could make a case that he's just as guilty as they are in the end. He's just not in as much of a hurry, maybe. So anyway, I'll link to this article at the Atlantic because it's very interesting to read about the child who was actually at the crux of the case back in 1973 from a Christian perspective, because it's written from a very secular, wicked, evil, corrupt, destructive perspective. But if members of this audience read it, they're going to read it from a perspective that will shine an awful lot of light on the hearts of the people, not only involved in Jane Roe, Norma McCorvey's story, but in the writing of this story in The Atlantic now, circa 2021. The story is all about how Norma McCorvey went to find her third child, which was the baby at the center of Roe. And it's interesting in the story that Norma McCorvey did not seek to find her other two children that she had given up for adoption because she was a bit of a slut and got herself pregnant upon occasion. Never really got married. She never sought to find those two because what she was really looking for was some publicity and some money. And so she thought that if she could find the baby that the pro-life movement had kind of christened this child the Roe baby, because the Roe baby was never aborted. By the way, just so you know, the Supreme Court, because it takes so long to do anything, can't make up its mind, doesn't know what to do. So the baby was born and lived a life. Her name was Shelley. And Shelley thought her mom was just looking for publicity, and Shelley didn't want to meet her mom. Shelley was angry at her mom. Norma McCorvey wanted Shelley to be thankful that Norma McCorvey was her mom, and Shelley wasn't. In fact, in the article, she pretty much comes right out and say, what am I supposed to thank you for getting knocked up and then wanting to abort me? And that you happened to run out of time and you couldn't do it? I'm supposed to be thankful for you? I'm supposed to want to hang out with you? Oh, and by the way, then you just gave me away because, you know, my mom just abandoned me, wanted to kill me, couldn't pull that off. She wants to abandon me. So anyway, the whole story is how Shelley has been damaged. Antidepressants, depression, all of that. Even after she had at least one child and then decided she didn't want to have any more children because she was depressed. She didn't like her life. And that she never felt comfortable around anybody. She never felt like she could be anybody's friend 100%. It's just really a sad story about... And of course, The Atlantic Monthly, they say that Shelley, the Roe baby, that Shelley represents not the sanctity of life. No, because The Atlantic would never acknowledge the sanctity of life. They say Shelley is really all about how difficult it is to be born unwanted. That's... What? Really? Is that... Yeah, being born unwanted is... It leads to a tough road to hoe. But if you ask Shelley, do you think she would rather have been butchered? I don't think so. But the article never gets into that. And it also barely mentions Norma McCorvey's Christian conversion for whatever that Christian conversion was worth. That, now having read more about Norma McCorvey, and not just this article, but I've read a number of pieces on her since she died. She died in 2017, by the way. Anyway, her Christian conversion appears to have been something of a publicity stunt as well. I mean, I hope it was sincere. I hope so. But anyway... She's not exactly a paragon of virtue, was Norma McCorvey. But anyway, the Atlantic barely mentions her Christian conversion and only in association with her being, quote, fundamentally unhappy. There's one paragraph in the article about Norma McCorvey's Christian conversion and her switching of sides from pro-abortion to anti-abortion. There's only one paragraph, and it ends with, she was fundamentally unhappy. See how they stick that word fundamental in there, huh? Hey, I'm not going to say that the people at The Atlantic are not good writers. They're good writers. But just so they know, I'm a good reader, and I notice stuff like that. You stuck the word fundamental right in the middle of fundamentally unhappy as you talked about Norma's conversion and the people she hung out with after she became a Christian. Anyway, we'll all find out if Norma McCorvey's conversion was... sincere. We'll find that out one day all together, if we care to even be. We probably won't care about things like that when we get there. It'll just be like, oh, you're here, wow, and then we'll see each other clearly for the first time, and it'll be great. All right, so now let's come back to Earth. After all that, we go to the widespread cowardice file, where people in England, according to Breitbart, this is from, I guess they got a story off from the Telegraph over there in London. there's been a significant increase in people falling down the stairs going into the London Underground because people are afraid of catching coronavirus from the handrails. So they won't hold on to the handrails, and so they fall down the stairs into the underground, which is like concrete steps. Another significant factor to blame for the injuries is drunkenness. So if you're in England, even when they're drunk, they're scared of catching the coronavirus, and they won't hold on to the handrails. I don't even have to be drunk. I hold on to the handrails. I remember when I was young, I remember wondering, what are these handrails for? And just running up and down, and I could have cared less, had no fear. Now I hold the handrails, and I walk. Sometimes I put both feet on each step. But anyway, in England, the mental damage, the psychological damage is so severe because England is so far post-Christian. These people are so terrified of dying because they know they're going straight to hell, or at least they don't know where they're going, and they're terrified. So they're so scared they won't grab the handrails when, you know, all good sense would say, look, you're over 50. You know, you're not only are your legs not what they used to be, your hand-eye coordination ain't what it used to be, buddy. And now you've had a couple of pints. You might want to grab the handrail. Oh, no, Corona. Okay. Let's see here. They quote a study. this is unbelievable. So there was a study back in February the government released there in England. And they said that this study proves that there are no traces of the Chinese virus on any shared surfaces. They don't stick to the handrails, people. Here's a study. But by then, nobody believed them anymore. Nobody believes the government anymore. Pretty much anywhere in the world, everyone's like, well, I don't know what to believe. I mean, we could fall back on the 150 years of, you know, science on infectious disease that we all pretty much had agreed on before all this, but we're not going to do that. We're going to freak out and assume that if we touch something, we're going to die. Well, guess what? If you fall down the stairs at the underground, you might die. Row right under the tube there, mate. Something like that. It's like, wow, it's scary. Anyway, listen to this. Some of the polls they cite in this article are shocking. 80% of people in Britain felt some level of nervousness at the end of the lockdown. 80% of the people were scared that they were going to not lock down anymore. What? I know. It's shocking. 70% of people in England today, 70% say they would feel unsafe in a crowd without a mask. Wow. 70%. Talk about the psychological trauma that these ignorant heathens have suffered. If they weren't my enemies, it would be laughable. And you know what? I do have some measure of pity for them. Just enough to tell them that God is real. Jesus Christ came to earth and he said he could save the world. And then he proved that he had power over death. And I believe it. That's the extent of the grace that I'm willing to extend to these horrifically cowardice people. That's it. That's all I can do. And that's the Weekly Worldview, folks. I want to thank everyone for being with me, especially who do I usually thank? Oh, American Right to Life, of course. And the Personhood Alliance, I thank them. Real Science Radio, of course. Another thing that's been decided is that Real Science Radio is going to attempt to continue somehow without Bob. I'm not sure how that happens, but hey, with God, there's hope in anything. So, and I want to thank my other brother, Daryl, for making it all happen. Here at the Weekly Worldview, should the Lord tarry, we will return next week. And now I've got some extra time here, right? So I tried to hit my time marks for the terrestrial radio folks. But you folks who are listening on the podcast, you get an extra 30 seconds or so, I think. And so what can we talk about? Well, we've talked about the terrified people. From the confirmation of everything I said file, a former FDA commissioner. That's right. What's this? He was on Face the Nation, right? This is big news. What's this fella's name? Maybe he doesn't want to give his name because he's so ashamed of what he's about to say. He basically admitted that the 6-foot rule that they recommended that they still recommend and the stickers are still on the floor. He said nobody knows where that came from. That's right. He said the CDC, if they'd have said you only had to keep kids 3 feet apart, a lot of schools would have stayed open, but we decided on 6 feet. Why? Well, nobody really knows. That's right. Doesn't know where it came from. He says ultimately it was completely arbitrary, and that's why we were able to change it to 3 feet later, is because the 6 feet was a scam. The CDC had said, let's try 10 feet, and people thought, well, 10 feet, that's kind of hard to measure. Because I don't know why. How is it any harder to measure 10 feet than 6 feet? Oh, no, they knew that that would have too deleterious an effect on the economy too quickly, and people would probably rebel more quickly. So they set it at 6 feet to try to thread the needle, so to speak. And there you have it. Anyway, this article that I pulled down from where? Where did I get this? Oh, from Breitbart. They wonder in the article if this undermines Americans' confidence in advice from public health officials. Gee, do you think? Maybe? I mean, I never even went to college. I don't have a degree. I don't work in the government. I'm not a public health official. I'm not a doctor. Don't know much about public health at all. But the minute I heard 6 feet, the first thing I said was, where did that come from? And then I looked for days, because what else did I have to do? And my phone wasn't ringing. My business was closed. I mean, not on my account. I didn't close it. My customers closed it as they all hid under their beds. Anyway, I said, where did it come from? And I said, nowhere. It came from nothing. Nothing. Nowhere. And now this official his name is Gottlieb. I don't have his first name. He was on Face the Nation and he said it. We don't know where it came from. You know, could have been 3, could have been 6. Well, you got 6. There you go. All right. That's it, folks. It's the Weekly Worldview. I already said my goodbyes, but I'll say them again. I want to thank my friends at Real Science Radio and American Right to Life for all the good work they do. And should the Lord tarry, we shall return next week. And until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.
This is Dominic, and you're cutting in over Doug's outro. I want to remind you, we will be celebrating the life of my father, Bob Enyar, at Applewood Baptist Church this Saturday, October 2nd. Doors open at 9 a.m. Hope to see you there as we celebrate the life of my father, Bob Enyar. This is Dominic Enyar reminding you to do right and risk the consequences.